and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Kristen.
So on November 5th, Election Day in the United States, the Republican Party won control of the presidency, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. Importantly, this Republican sweep gives President-elect Donald Trump opportunity to push through key aspects of his policy agenda, including tax cuts and tariffs, which he promised on the campaign trail. Even before the election, 2025 was already set to be an important year for tax policy, because of the meeting of various impending disruptors, two of which we'll focus on today. The first of these disruptors is the 2025 tax cliff, or the expiration of nearly all individual and many business favorable provisions from the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or the TCJA. The second is global reform and the implementation of Pillar 2 globally, including the expiration of the UTPR safe harbor. In today's episode, we'll talk about how the election results, coupled with these tax policy disruptors, could impact tax policy both domestically as well as globally in 2025 and beyond. For our discussion today, we're joined by friends of the podcast, Dan Winnick, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice, who previously served as tax counsel for the House Committee on Ways and Means and as an attorney advisor with the Treasury Department Office of Tax Policy, and Michael Plougin, a principal in the same group and recently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Tax Affairs at the Treasury Department. Welcome back to the podcast, Dan and Michael.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Kristen. Great to be back.
Such august guests. Let's start by setting the stage, specifically the post-election state of play in Congress. Dan, we know the Republicans have control over both the House and Senate, but by what margins?
Thanks, Gary. So both the House and Senate are quite close. In the Senate, all of the races have now been decided, or the losing candidates have conceded, and so we'll have a 53-47 split with the Republicans in control. The House is even closer. It's looking like we're going to have the closest House in recent history. Right now, with three seats still to be decided, the House is split 219-213 with Republicans in control. These numbers may change following the inauguration, since President-elect Trump has nominated members of both the House and the Senate to serve in his cabinet. Senate seats will generally be filled quickly by appointment once those nominees are confirmed, but House seats remain vacant until a special election can be held. So the margins in the House might get even closer.
Wow, that's really close. So what does the narrowness of the margins mean for tax legislation?
Well, in the Senate, the lack of a 60-vote supermajority to overcome a filibuster means that tax legislation that's not bipartisan legislation will likely have to rely on the reconciliation process, which is a mechanism for passing taxing and spending legislation that covers a 10-year budget window. And it allows legislation to be passed with a bare majority of 51 votes in the Senate. Reconciliation can be difficult in practice, though, because there are multiple constraints on the process.
Let's talk about that. So we've heard a lot about reconciliation recently. In fact, both the TCJ and the IRA were passed through reconciliation. Can you elaborate on the reconciliation process for our listeners, Dan?
Sure, Gary. So budget reconciliation is a multi-step process. It begins with a budget resolution and reconciliation instructions. Once that budget resolution is passed, Congress can take up the bill that is eventually signed into law and creates the substantive changes that are being passed. So the reconciliation instructions that are in the budget resolution set a top line deficit amount for each congressional committee that is allocated a piece of the bill. Once that number is set, that limit must be strictly adhered to. What this means is that legislation cannot increase the deficit within a budget window by more than the amount allowed in the instructions. In addition, in reconciliation, legislation cannot increase the deficit outside the budget window in any individual year, not even by a penny. And in recent years, the budget window has been a 10-year period. So you have 10 years during which you can increase the deficit, but after that 10-year period, the bill has to be revenue neutral or raise money. So this structure puts additional pressure on Congress because legislation passed under reconciliation must be revenue neutral outside the window and can lead to a lot of expiring tax provisions or tax provisions that change toward the end of the window. There are some additional constraints besides those revenue and deficit constraints for reconciliation to pass. The bill cannot touch extraneous measures, so that means you can't change policy items or items where the tax and spending effect is negligible. And you can't spend outside the instructions, and you can't make changes that would impact Social Security. In addition, reconciliation instructions can only be issued once every fiscal year. So if we reach September 30th, 2025, without any legislation passing the Senate, any work is essentially lost and Congress has to start over. So the new administration will get at least two opportunities to do reconciliation before the midterm elections, once after the inauguration and a second time after September 30th, 2025. The close margins in the House and Senate create tension because it means every vote counts, especially with the close margins in the House. And depending on how the numbers shake out, a group of three or four representatives or senators could kill any bill or hold it up until their concern is addressed. The Republican whips on each side who are responsible for ensuring party members vote in line with the party are going to have a very busy 2 years.
So I don't recall Schoolhouse Rock saying anything about reconciliation. So thanks for the refresher, Dan. As I noted before, we've gone down this path before. How is the dynamic today different than it was back in 2017 when the Republicans were able to pass the TCJA through reconciliation?
Well, I think the first point to note that differentiates this coming Congress to the Congress that passed TCJA is the size of the margins. In the Senate, it was pretty similar. The Republicans had a 52-48 majority. So this majority is actually slightly larger than what they had when TCJA passed. But in the House, they had a 47-vote Republican majority, and passage was still tense because of the constraints on reconciliation, not to raise the deficit in years outside the window and the constraint to pay for a large portion of the policy changes that were being made in order to satisfy the reconciliation instruction. And so a number of members, Republican members in the House, actually voted against the bill. One of the biggest issues with the passage of TCJA was finding pay-fors and keeping the bill revenue neutral. The SALT cap was a significant pay-for that was really politically significant. It limits the amount of state and local taxes that can be deducted by an individual for federal income tax purposes. And this was a highly contentious point, especially for representatives from higher tax states like New York, New Jersey, and California. The SALT cap is a continuing issue, and while the House members who cared about the SALT cap during the TCJA negotiations had little power due to the larger margin of members in the majority in the House, the closer margin, this means that this time those members would have the ability to essentially veto a bill unless they're satisfied. Other pay-fors include international and corporate provisions, such as Section 965, the one-time transition tax. That one-time tax is no longer available to pay for revenue within the window because it was a one-time event. And similarly, the transition to current inclusion under GILTI was a one-time change in law and a permanent change in law. So that's another source of revenue that won't be available for this bill. These new provisions help keep TCJA within the reconciliation instruction during and outside the 10-year budget window. To keep TCJA revenue neutral beyond the budget window, a lot of the individual provisions and some of the business provisions began to sunset, expire, or change in the tail end of the 10-year window. In particular, the SALT cap and AMT exemption amounts. The SALT cap is eliminated and AMT returns to its prior level. The GILTI, FDII, and BEAT rates all increase, and the BEAT credit provisions become less generous. individual income tax rates and the standard deduction and personal exemption return to their pre-TCJA levels. That's a huge change in revenue because that affects nearly every individual taxpayer. And the Section 199A pass-through deduction expires. Many of the provisions expire or change beginning in 2026 because in reconciliation, it's hard to have a provision that lasts longer than 8 years without impacting years outside the 10-year budget window. But we've already seen some of the TCJA taxpayer favorable provisions begin to expire or phase down. For example, the phase down in bonus depreciation, the shift in Section 163J from EBITDA to EBIT, and the change in Section 174 to provide for capitalization of research and experimental expenses.
Thanks, Dan. So as we mentioned at the start of the podcast, 2025 is set to be a really big year for tax, regardless of the outcome of the election, because as you mentioned, the looming tax cliff resulting from the expected sunsetting expiring provisions. The JCT has estimated that the cost of extending the expiring TCJA provisions, which is one of the main goals of the Trump administration and a Republican Congress, is $4 to $5 trillion within a 10-year window. Also, that amount is the cost before layering in any other new specific tax policies that the president-elect discussed on the campaign trail, such as the 15% domestic manufacturing tax rate or no tax on tips. Dan, Michael, do you think it's possible for the Republicans to extend these expiring TCJA provisions through reconciliation?
Congress can extend TCJA provisions through reconciliation, though they probably can't make them permanent. We have one estimate from the CBO of the cost of extending those provisions for the next 10 fiscal years, and that would cost about $4 to $5 trillion. Congress can extend the provisions for a shorter period, and it would be much cheaper to do so for a shorter period, but that would still leave a significant budget deficit. TCJA expiration represents one of the most significant tax events since the TCJA's enactment, and it'll impact business in multiple ways. It'll also impact nearly every taxpayer. In some respects, there is a political necessity for the new Congress to prevent the tax increases on individuals. I think many members would be very concerned if their constituents woke up on January 1st, 2026, facing 5 to 10% increase in their taxes. And so I think they'll be very motivated to address this fiscal cliff. On the other hand, it's important to note that there are a number of other challenges facing the new Congress. Right now, Congress has a continuing resolution to fund appropriations that expires on December 20th, and the debt limit is scheduled to kick back into force on January 1st. So the members of Congress have indicated that extending TCJA and through a reconciliation bill is one of their highest priorities. They'll have some other must-dos on the calendar when they come back for the new Congress next year.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Dan. Congress obviously has a lot on its plate, but preventing tax increases on individuals will be a top priority. With the numbers that we're throwing around, though, a key question is going to be how much the new Congress wants to use deficit financing. So, Dan, as you said when you were talking about reconciliation, they're going to have to agree on a limit to how much they will add to the deficit in the 10-year window. And that's obviously going to be a politically sensitive issue. And we've started to hear some folks in Congress argue that they should use what's known as a current policy baseline instead of the current law baseline. And that would minimize the apparent increase in the deficit. What that would mean using a current policy baseline is that even though the law currently says that these tax cuts expire at the end of the year, nobody actually wants them to expire. So we're going to measure the cost of these tax provisions against what we intended, rather than what the current law says. And that would obviously significantly decrease the cost because extending the existing tax cuts wouldn't cost anything under that math. But for purposes of this discussion, I think we should assume that they're going to use a current law baseline, what the law currently says. And under that assumption, even if they only extend the TCJA tax cuts for a few years, that could still be a significant number. So Congress might still need to come up with some major pay-fors if they want to be able to even temporarily extend the TCJA provisions.
That's right. And because of the close margin in both the House and the Senate, Congress will need to be very careful and considerate about the pay-fors that they choose to ensure that they get the votes they need for everything to pass. They'll really need a lot of consensus about the content of the pay-fors. I think that the top line number that they choose for the maximum amount of a budget deficit increase will also be very sensitive and highly negotiated. So right off the bat, they will have a tough negotiation necessary to get the ball rolling on the bill.
We've talked a lot about the need for pay-fors, but Dan, what are the possible revenue raisers to allow Congress to extend the TCJA provisions?
Well, when you start a bill like this, I think it's common for the congressional staffs who work on these measures to really try to keep all options on the table for members to consider. And so they're looking back at provisions or changes in law that have been already drafted or ideas that have been fleshed out either internally or by others in sources like past introduced legislation that maybe didn't make it over the line, or the president's green book, or just the work they've been doing internally to try to find potential pay-fors. There are a few that we've heard consistently that are probably worth mentioning. One is an increase in the stock buyback excise tax. So that was passed as part of IRA by Democrats. It didn't receive a lot of opposition from Republicans compared to other provisions in that bill. Another possibility that we've heard is tariffs. It might be difficult to actually increase tariffs in a reconciliation bill, but if the administration imposes tariffs and that's a source of revenue, that might make members more comfortable voting for an increase in the budget deficit in the reconciliation instruction. So there's both the possibility of tariffs being in the bill, but also, and perhaps more likely, the possibility that tariffs will justify a little bit more deficit spending. There's also the possibility of repealing IRS funding that was increased during IRA and using that spending decrease to offset part of the cost of the bill. They may also look for other spending decreases outside of the tax area. And a significant item that's come up again and again is repealing or limiting IRA green energy credits. Now, this is tricky because these credits are also temporary because the IRA was passed through reconciliation. So there may not be that much revenue to be raised by repealing those credits prospectively, particularly when you take into account that there would likely need to be transition rules that allow completed projects to continue to benefit from the credits. And I expect that with the IRA credits that they'll need to examine them credit by credit and consider the impact on their members and on different projects before actually trying to sunset the credits.
Dan, when you were at the House, you worked on the BBBA. I forget how many Bs are in there. But any chance that the Republicans could mine some proposals in that legislation, notwithstanding that was obviously a Democratic initiative?
I think that's a great example, Gary. When we were putting BBBA together, we looked at provisions that were in the draft that our predecessors, when Chairman Camp was the head of Ways and Means, had put together that eventually became the TCJA. There were a number of provisions there that weren't enacted into law that we looked at as potential revenue raisers. I think that they'll also look at the revenue raisers that were in BBBA that weren't passed into law to see if there are any elements that they want to pick up. There also might be elements that are taxpayer favorable in certain circumstances. The taxpayers come to the congressional committees and ask for them, changes that they asked for them to make. So I think that's a good example of existing legislation on the shelf that they might look to.
Dan, you talked a little bit about the IRA credits. And one question that's come up frequently since the election is how the new administration will treat the IRA's largest pay-for, which was CAMTI. Do you think that the new administration will repeal CAMTI?
Well, nothing's impossible, but to me, it seems improbable that CAMTI will end up being repealed. Repeal would be expensive, especially in years beyond the budget window. And they would also probably have to pay out any accumulated CAMTI credits as they did when they repealed the old alternative minimum tax. So that's another potential cost. Also, the new administration, in a way, needs CAMTI as an additional revenue raiser. That's not to say that the new administration might not look back to legislation passed in the Biden administration, reconsider choices made, especially at an administrative level. But I think at its core, CAMPD is here to stay for now.
I'm sure our listeners will be excited about that. So thanks, Dan. Let's shift our focus to how this election impacts global tax reform, in particular Pillar 2. Michael, when we had you on the pod last, you mentioned that while you didn't think Congress would directly adopt a Pillar 2 regime, cut and paste the OECD's work into our code, it wasn't outside the realm of possibility that the U.S. could make Pillar 2 consistent reforms to existing U.S. tax laws. Have your thoughts evolved post-election?
Well, on the first point, right, the chance of Congress implementing Pillar 2 in full is still zero. As you say, Congress doesn't just cut and paste OECD recommendations. That's not how this works. But with the Republican sweep, I think it becomes less likely that the U.S. would adopt any Pillar 2 consistent reforms. However, as we've been discussing, Congress will need revenue raisers or pay-fors if they're going to achieve their tax policy goals. So one question is whether making changes to U.S. tax law to make it more consistent with Pillar 2 raises much revenue. And in particular, people have looked at making GILTI country by country or making FTCs country by country. And the short answer to that question is that that type of reform at this point probably doesn't raise a lot of revenue. Now, why is that? That really has to do with the foreign tax credit regime. And in December of last year, IRS and Treasury issued Notice 2023-80, which says that QDMTTs will be creditable for FTC purposes. And a lot of countries have implemented QDMTTs or even just regular corporate income taxes, right? Non-QDMTT corporate income taxes in response to Pillar 2. So I think most companies are going to have enough foreign tax credits to shield themselves from additional tax or material additional tax under a country-by-country GILTI regime. So that change may not raise much revenue at this point. Revenue that is raised by a country-by-country GILTI regime would really come from two sources. One would be jurisdictions that don't have a QDMTT or a corporate income tax, and there are just fewer and fewer of those. The other is from timing differences in the GILTI base versus the QDMTT base, right? So the GILTI base is a U.S. tax base, while the QDMTT base is essentially book accounting income. And because the QDMTT doesn't give credit for taxes paid under GILTI, you'd effectively be double taxing that income.
A couple points. I mean, we're about to enter into a period where the Republicans are going to be diving for dollars, right? And so it is true that with QDMTTs, there's less juice to squeeze out of GILTI. But if the GILTI rate goes up to above 16% as it's scheduled to, and you have this country by country would just exacerbate these timing differences, no more blending, there could be some revenue there. And then there's also the question, and I've heard that there are some taxpayers who might want country by country insofar as it protects their CFCs from UTPRs. So there could be some advocating for that.
That's right. On that last point in particular, there are some companies I've heard from who say, look, from a compliance perspective, applying the UTPR to my CFCs, putting aside whether the UTPR applies to U.S. profits, that would be a significant compliance burden or a simplification to have the UTPR not apply to CFCs. So that's something that there is some interest in. As you say, there probably is also some revenue in country by country GILTI, particularly if the rate is allowed to float up to 16.4% as scheduled.
We're going to talk about the UTPR in a second, but staying with GILTI for a second, the presumption at some point was that the OECD was going to treat a GILTI that was C by C and a higher rate as a qualified IAR which again would then protect the CFCs of U.S. multinationals from the application of the UTPR. Is that still on the table? Will the OECD still accept that deal?
Well, it's not the OECD, right? It's every other country in the world that would have to accept it. And we don't know the answer to that, to be honest. But as you say, that was the deal in 2021. And my expectation is that if that's what actually happened, we got country by country guilty at a 15 or 16% rate, that would be adequate, that countries would accept that as being good enough for the US to have effectively a qualified IIR.
So what you're saying is it's good enough for government work.
Exactly.
So we've talked a lot about Pillar 2 on this podcast, and one of the primary concerns from the perspective of a U.S. multinational is the application of the UTPR to U.S. income, particularly by reason of non-refundable credits like the R&D credit, lowering their ETR for purposes of the Pillar 2 top-up tax. There are no UTPRs that are effective in 2024, and U.S. multinationals should be protected from the UTPR through 2025 under the specific UTPR safe harbor, which applies to any headquarter jurisdiction that has a 20% or greater headline rate. How might a Trump administration react to other countries applying their UTPRs to U.S. income post-2025?
So this has been a hot button topic, especially among Republicans who have said that they consider the UTPR as unfairly targeting U.S. multinationals and taxing back benefits that the U.S. has granted. And so I think we might expect to see retaliatory measures against UTPRs that apply to U.S. profits of U.S. multinationals. And those could include tariffs, possible trade restrictions, or retaliatory tax policies enacted by Congress. And in fact, Republicans have proposed retaliatory taxes against UTPRs and DSTs. And that's a potential revenue raiser that Congress might use to pay for TCJA extension or other tax cuts. Right. And so the two proposals that we saw in 2023, one of them would have implemented additional taxes or raised the rate on U.S. income of residents of jurisdictions with a UTPR or a digital services tax, a DST. That bill would have increased the rate of U.S. tax up to 20 percentage points above existing rates. The other proposal would have made changes to the BEAT for foreign parented groups with operations in jurisdictions with a UTPR. And those changes would have eliminated the threshold for the BEAT, so the 3% base erosion tax benefit threshold and the revenue threshold. It would have eliminated the SCM exception for services priced at cost, and it would have disallowed 50% of cost of goods sold in the BEAT calculation. So, you know, I think there's a pretty obvious domestic political logic to these types of retaliatory measures in that they can be seen as both standing up to other countries, but also raising revenue that the Congress is going to want to pay for other priorities. But at the same time, they could certainly impact trade relations and cooperation on global issues.
Wouldn't this all just be easier if the U.S. were exempt from the UTPR, Michael? And I mean, is there a path forward? Is there a path forward to the, I guess it's not the OECD anymore, it's every other country to permanently exempt the U.S. from the UTPR?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously would be easier for the U.S. not to be subject to the UTPR. And as to whether there's a path forward, these are complicated negotiations. It's sort of like congressional negotiations, right? There are so many different players. It's hard to predict exactly how it'll play out. But my starting point on this is that I don't think countries initially planned to impose the UTPR on the United States. That's not what people thought was going to happen. It's not how the UTPR was designed. On the other hand, now that Pillar 2 is in effect in a lot of countries, there are real level playing field concerns. And in that context, it might be hard for countries to say, we're not going to apply the UTPR to the United States. On the other hand, though, it's possible that the United States exerts a lot of pressure through tax and trade measures. And you know, you could certainly see negotiators finding a way to ease that tension, possibly by extending the current UTPR safe harbor, which, as you mentioned, is based on a jurisdiction's headline rate. But if they go down that road, that means that the corporate tax rate in the U.S. would have to stay at least 20% to qualify for the UTPR safe harbor. So I don't want to overstate the likelihood that the UTPR safe harbor is extended, especially given some of the other tensions that exist between the U.S. and the rest of the world, including the EU. But it is something that negotiators will be very focused on and trying to get resolved. Alternatively, a way they could go would be for countries in the inclusive framework to find a way to address specific U.S. incentives like the R&D credit, right? That's a bipartisan issue in the U.S. The R&D credit does not undermine the policy objectives of Pillar 2, and that ought to be something that they could deal with at the inclusive framework and get that result.
Michael, any chance that the U.S. just pulls out of the inclusive framework?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. We don't know who the tax team will be at Treasury. But I would make the point that, you know, as we talked about, it might be possible to get an extension of the UTPR safe harbor. It might be possible to get resolution of the treatment of the U.S. R&D credit. But those things would really have to be done at the inclusive framework. And so I think, you know, Treasury might view it as being important to remain at the table to get those issues resolved.
So as we wrap up this episode, Dan, Michael, any final thoughts?
What I would say is that there's just a tremendous high pressure push and pull in the system, both domestically and internationally. Domestically, there's a lot of pressure to extend tax cuts, especially for individuals. But there is also some growing concern about deficits. On the international side, we've seen tensions building between the U.S. and really the rest of the world for about the past 10 years on the tax side. And we see Republicans looking to take a more aggressive stance on those issues. And to me, it'll be fascinating to see how negotiators, both domestically and internationally, handle those tensions and get them resolved.
I agree with that, Michael. And in spite of all those challenges, I think that Congress will be strongly motivated by those expiring tax provisions to get a bill passed next year. And once a bill is moving, it does have the potential to move quickly. So I think 2025 will be a tremendous transitional year for tax and very exciting for tax practitioners.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Michael, for your insights on the post-election landscape for U.S. and global tax policy. And a special thanks to Casey Caldwell for her help behind the scenes with this episode. While the future of tax in the U.S. is hardly clear, we look forward to seeing how this all plays out in the coming months, and we'll, of course, keep you, our listeners, updated on it all. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.